Okay, coming up next we have Audrey Allen Stanbridge, who is an associate professor at the Department of Arts, Culture and Media at the University of Toronto. He's cross-appointed in graduate programs in music and museum studies. He's published in numerous articles and book chapters on popular music, jazz history, cultural policy, and his research has been supported by a grant from SHRC. And he's currently working on a book entitled Rhythm Changes, Jazz, Culture, and Discourse, which is to be published by Routledge. So his presentation is entitled All the Rest is Propaganda, Jazz, Class, and Race in British New Wave Cinema.
Okay, let me see. I'm going to plunge straight in. I've got a few film clips. If I get to them all, that's great. If I don't, that's too bad. Carl Rice's Saturday Night and Sunday Morning from 1960, one of the defining texts of British New Wave cinema, opens with a pan across the shop floor of the Raleigh Bicycle Factory in Nottingham. It's in the Midlands of England, for those of you who don't know. The camera zooms slowly in on our protagonist, Arthur Seaton, played by Albert Finney in his first starring role, working a lathe, churning out bicycle crankshafts. As he presses the control button on the lathe, we hear an accordion start to play a jazz-inspired theme. Arthur's internal monologue speaks to the repetitive boredom of working-class life and to Arthur's unwillingness to succumb to these pressures. Underscoring Arthur's belligerent ruminations, the accordion continues to outline the melody, which will soon emerge as the soundtrack's central theme. Credit sequence rolls, we see everybody leaving the factory. Arthur returns to his mum and dad's terraced house. He grabs some dinner. He retreats to his upstairs bedroom, and the swinging jazz score, playing the same theme we heard here, but now much more kind of coherently, captures his exuberance as he breaks out a freshly cleaned suit, preparing to catch the bus for a night out on the town.
Thank you.
So the score for Saturday Night and Sunday Morning was by the English jazz composer and performer John, or as he styled himself in those early days, Johnny Dankworth. K.J. Donnelly has suggested that Dankworth's, quote, breezy and brash music was apt for this foundational film of the British New Wave, further differentiating the film from British cinematic tradition. But the use of jazz in this film, coupled with its key themes, working class alienation, anger, adultery, acquiescence, acceptance, and apparently alliteration too, also set it apart from American cinematic tradition and suggested a significantly broader signifying role for jazz in the movies. In American movies of the 1950s and early 1960s, the use of jazz, whether as source or soundtrack music, tended to serve a pre-assigned semiotic role. Most often, jazz connoted the seamy underbelly of contemporary life, and the music became the ubiquitous soundtrack for movies featuring criminality and drug addiction. For example, I Want to Live, the true story of murderous Barbara Graham. Feel that music, Daddy, oh Papa, play that jazz. Or The Man with the Golden Arm, which features Sinatra as a jazz drummer and heroin addict. The music also served a similar function in an endless parade of police detective and private eye television series. Peter Gunn, music by Henry Mancini, and Staccato with music by Elmer Bernstein. But if the nature and character of the jazz and jazz-inspired music employed in American film and television became increasingly codified along the lines established by composers such as Johnny Mandel, Mancini, and Bernstein, an examination of the music employed in British films of the same era reveals a wider musical and semiotic range, and a willingness on the part of British composers to move beyond these American archetypes. One immediate question, what have I got next? I can't remember. Oh no, I don't want that yet. Well, we'll leave it there. One immediate question in the British New Wave context is why jazz? Why jazz to accompany these peculiarly English working class kitchen sink dramas? Saturday Night and Sunday Morning wasn't the first British movie to utilize jazz in this way. The extended semiotic potential is similarly evident in some of the early work in the free cinema documentary movement, which preceded, influenced, and indeed involved many of the British New Wave filmmakers, most notably Carl Rice and Tony Richardson. In the work of these directors, jazz occupies a unique and uniquely British role, whether in the free cinema documentaries Mama Don't Allow and We Are the Lambeth Boys, or in the social dramas The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner and Look Back in Anger. So, in these films of British working class life, the use of jazz as soundtrack music was a specifically political decision, I argue. For left-leaning filmmakers such as Rice and Richardson, classical music represented the conservative establishment, while in orthodox Frankfurt School fashion, popular music was regarded as an aspect of mass culture, which was the subject of critique, whether implicitly through its absence or explicitly through its presence. Hence, jazz was the music of choice, although it was a choice that was not without its own tensions and contradictions. It's also interesting to note that in interviews, Dankworth has observed that it was Rice who specified the use of the accordion in Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, and the instrument was not one that Dankworth would have otherwise used. He did concede, however, quote, "I still don't know why it works, but I've got to admit that it does work in a way in the context in which it's used." Although Dankworth remained unclear regarding Rice's motivation in specifying the accordion, one could speculate that Rice valued it for its folk associations, which distances its jazz context in the film even further from mass or commercial culture. Dankworth's music for the opening credits, which I didn't take the time to show you, certainly reflect this overlap with folk traditions. So in the various films I've identified, and in many other examples of the British New Wave, working class culture is both celebrated and patronized at the same time, with a distinction drawn between authentic working class culture and the encroachment of commercialized mass culture. In the scene immediately preceding the last one I showed you from Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, Arthur berates his father for watching too much television. And in The Loneliest and Long Distance Runner, Colin Smith, played by Tom Courtney, turns his back on the television brought to his home by his mother's lover. As John Hill has argued, quote, "A respect for the traditional working class and hostility to the corruptions of modern mass culture are not opposed, but part of one and the same response to the economic and cultural developments of the 1950s. It's a tension, moreover, which is characteristic of the work of the New Wave as a whole," unquote. As Hill suggests, the trope is both a familiar and problematic one, evident in some of the early British cultural studies literature, including Richard Hoggett's The Uses of Literacy and Stuart Hall and Paddy Wannell's The Popular Arts. Tellingly, in this latter text, we find the following passage, quote, "Throughout, we have constantly made comparisons between pop music and jazz. This is because there are many individual pop songs worth listening to. In general, jazz seems an infinitely richer kind of music, both aesthetically and emotionally." These sentiments are echoed by Jimmy Porter, played by Richard Burton in Look Back in Anger, who argues, and he argues a lot, that anyone who doesn't like jazz, quote, has no feeling for music or people. Rice and Richardson were clearly of a similar mind, and their first co-directed documentary, Mama Don't Allow, was set in the Wood Green Jazz Club in North London and featured Chris Barber's trad jazz band, which included on banjo a young Lonnie Donegan, who would go on to be a major star of Brittle's skiffle scene. The opening sequence is especially relevant to our conference theme. As the Barber band warms up in the club, we see the evening's future working class patrons going about their day's work. And I'll just show you a little bit of this. This, of course, is all taking much longer than I thought. That's Lonnie. So just for the sake of time, I'll cut this here, but you get the general idea. We're using jazz as a soundtrack to these scenes of working class life. The rest of the 22-minute documentary features our working class protagonists dancing at the club and being joined in a sequence that's clearly scripted and acted, notwithstanding the film's documentary status, by a group of upper-class toffs slumming it at the jazz club. The English film critic Raymond Durnat summed up the problems with this film in his usual succinct fashion. Quote, "It's badly cut, badly shot, with no feelings for jazz, for dancing, for bodies, for clothes, or the place." Moreover, Durnat notes that the film, quote, "creates the impression that the jazz revival was widely popular among working class teenagers and was a working class phenomenon. In point of fact, the vast majority of working class teenagers preferred pop music and later rock and roll. When later trad reached the hit parade, it was only in watered down forms. The jazz revival was as much, if not primarily, a middle class phenomenon." So we've got an interesting phenomenon here, indeed, of like these liberal middle-class filmmakers almost retelling a history of the working class. Rice's subsequent free cinema documentary, We Are the Lambeth Boys, was his first collaboration with Dankworth prior to Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. The film has a similar emphasis on the quotidian nature of working-class work and leisure, although with its somewhat sanctimonious narration, it fails to escape Durnat's charge that the free cinema movement, quote, "achieved a kind of middle-class left-wing sentimentality within the purlieus of the art cinema and the film society." Have I got time to show you a little bit of this? Yes, I have.
Being a butcher, like everything else, means learning. Wood is getting good at it. With luck, he thinks he may be in the meat trade for life. Bob is a junior postman. Life can be dull for an internal messenger with odd jobs to do between errands. But Bob is keen on cars. He'll be driving a post office van soon, and his days will liven up. Beryl sits at a bench, making food in a factory. She has done for 3 years. Probably will do until she gets married.
I'll jump this forward a bit and you'll get the impression of what's going on here. So now we're cutting
after
to the
meal
club.
The change of clothes into a dark suit. The day's work is left behind. The weekend begins with paying subs at the club. All the same, Friday is the most popular night of the week. Everybody comes. Thank you.
Dankworth went on to explore this this kind of extended approach to the use of jazz in a number of film soundtracks and also music for TV over the years. But he wasn't alone in exploring these broader possibilities. And the work of the English composer Philip Green is especially relevant here. Green is one of the great unsung heroes of British film music, scoring over 150 films and serving as house arranger with Decca and as music director for the Rank organization. He worked extensively with Basil Dearden and Michael Relf, and also with Roy Ward Baker. And I'm going to jump just to show you the clip. Fascinating movie by Baker called Flame in the Streets, with music by Green. This was just some of the other movies he worked on, where he actually conforms much more to the American model. Sapphire, a really interesting Dearden movie, with music by Green, played by the Johnny Dankworth Orchestra. All Night Long, fascinating movie that features Dave Brubeck, Charlie Mingus, John Dankworth, Tubby Hayes. But this movie, Flame in the Streets, is a fascinating movie for its time. It's from 1961. And it's about an interracial love affair between Sylvia Sims and Johnny Secca, who both play school teachers. It's set on the 5th of November, which of course in Britain is Guy Fawkes Night, where there's a rather strange ritual of making straw guys, clothing them, and then throwing them on bonfires. But I think Green's music for the opening credits is quite fascinating. We see the interracial couple walking to school together. It segues into a really nice calypso beat. It looks like racial harmony in the classroom, but then a jump cut takes us to a blackface guy, and I'll just show you that clip. Amazing performance by Brenda DeBanzi, by the way, who turns out to be the biggest racist of all, which is quite, it's still a compelling performance. But these are the opening credits. You've got a sort of Stan Kenton-like eight-bar introduction, very declamatory, quite tense, before we go into the calypso, and note how it just recurs again, just for a couple of bars before a jump cut. In case we're left in any doubt that there's an indication here of not quite so happy racial harmony, the blackface guy we see at the start there ends up getting thrown on the bonfire towards the end of the film. And also the foreman who John Mills, the very liberal father, is prepared to promote to foreman, a Jamaican guy, he also gets thrown on the bonfire and badly burned. It's a, you know, it's an incredible melodramatic movie. And we have this really bizarre moment where there's a very uneasy reconciliation between Nell and Jacko, and an uneasy acceptance of this relationship. So it's worthwhile noting, somewhat disappointingly, that Green doesn't follow through on his opening credits, and this final sequence is accompanied by some fairly typical Hollywood-style symphonic bombast. but the opening credits, I think, remain an intriguing example of his craftsmanship and hint at the possibilities for a somewhat more nuanced use of jazz and jazz-related music than we hear in many American movies. So the distinctively English films that I've addressed in this paper therefore represent a significant, and I think significantly political, break with the often firmly circumcised role of jazz in dominant American models. And all the rest is propaganda. Thank you. Say there's jazz in these movies. I mean, like, for instance, Loneliness and Long Distance Runner actually has a score by John Addison, who is a contemporary English composer. But it's a very avant-garde score, and it certainly is ignoring kind of traditional classical style Hollywood symphonic backing. Taste of Honey, I did watch months ago. But yes, I think you're right. It's not quite as easily locatable as that. But is that the movie where there's actually a scene in the club with John Barry's group? I think a little jazz scene in the club. Or maybe... Yeah, yeah. Right, yeah. And Long Distance Runner, again, the score is distinctive, but there's a really interesting moment when it's the first time that Tom Courtenay is allowed to actually go off on his own running through the woods. And it's swinging jazz that accompanies his running through the woods. I find still sometimes I watch these, I want to be more convinced. I find it sometimes quite jarring, but then I also think I'm dealing with my own, not prejudices, but just the fact that the symphonic score has become so normalized in movies that to see something different is quite unusual. And I think that this notion of the American model being quite firmly boxed in is one, I mean, I've watched, I don't know how many hundred movies over the last few months. I've been on sabbatical. And it really is fascinating the way that jazz is used. It's very tightly controlled. And so I think my key point here is more about specifically on the topic of jazz, just the fact that it's being given much more leeway here. It's being a much more scope to express other things, you know? Yeah, Scott? Oh, I'm doing it, is that okay?
This is kind of a curious question. I wonder if you look back a little bit, because you look back at Anger Starts as a Play, and Richardson is a director, theatrical director. In part, I mean, it's a youthful group who are creating this material, who are probably into jazz themselves. I'm wondering, did it show up in the earlier theater production? Because Jimmy is a jazz trumpeter in the play.
He's a jazz trumpeter in the play, although in the play we don't actually see or hear much jazz, and that was actually broadened out by Richardson for the movie. The interesting thing, and actually if anybody knows anything about this, please let me know. What became fascinating when I was doing some of this work was the incredible overlap between rock and roll in the English context and trad jazz. And there's a movie called Two Left Feet, Michael Crawford's first movie, where all the kids are dancing down the jazz club to, I forget who it is now, but it's a starring as themselves, a real English trad band. But all the dancing is jiving and twisting. And there's this, it's an overlap that seems to happen only in Britain. I mean, there's no North American equivalent to this. So I'm not really answering your question. I was just talking about more stuff I wanted to talk about, that was all.
It extends to Germany as well.
Okay.
There's a German mid-50s film where the kids all listen to pop kind of jazz in the cafe. Wild music.
Okay, well, I'll get that reference. We'll talk about that. There's a question up back, I think.
I've got things going on in my mind, so I'll try to make this somewhat coherent. The difference between Britain, I think this is sort of seeming what you're getting at. It comes a lot. You talk about the very different uptake of jazz as this very actually middle class, you know, very much, it wasn't the working classes who were adopting jazz. He was part of this. He was much more bourgeois, middle class bourgeois, who sort of had the cultural capital kind of take up this music, whereas the working classes were actually much more pop, rock and roll. And how that gets transposed onto this sort of working class culture. But then this last film that you talked about, this interracial era, and on Guy Fawkes Day, you know, it seems to be this sort of metaphor for the sort of the anti-Catholicism of that is, or like is that
the
anti-Catholicism, or the anti, because that like, I haven't seen the film, but that seems like a plausible reading that the interracial relationship is sort of standing in for the anti-Catholicism that Guy Fawkes is all about.
You could probably develop that argument. I don't think it's very dominant in the film. And I mean, again, if I'd had more time, and especially in terms of our conference theme, I mean, John Mills' role in the movie as the white foreman, who's actually very liberal, very progressive, very anti-racist, he finds out about his daughter's relationship with the black teacher. And then, of course, he becomes, that's a bit of a challenge for him, you know. So it's like, it's very much addressing a range of issues. Religion does not, I'm trying to remember if
it seems like it
functions sort of at all in the film, isn't it?
You know, Guy Fawkes being, you know, all, you know, going back to the yeah. problematic position
yeah.
in
yeah.
England, and how that then
but you
sort
need,
of an analog to the race relations in Britain.
You need to... Bear in mind, Guy Fawkes Night in Britain, a few people are thinking Catholicism and the nature of that. They're just thinking fireworks and bonfires and throwing straw effigies on those bonfires.
But the origins of that are...
Of course. But I think, you know, now, even in this time, in 61, I think that kind of particular meaning has been lost. Most people who set off fireworks on the 5th of November, I don't think could tell you much about the gunpowder plot or Guy Fawkes, you know. So... Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Just talking about the sort of the way that the class differences are mapped onto the different genres, so like rock and roll, the different working class conversations in jazz, potentially middle class, sort of more aspirational conversations. I think one film, slightly later film, where you really, really get a sense of that is actually My Heart Beats Night, because the two types of music in that film are the Beatles, and then exactly this kind of jazz.
Yeah.
And then you also have the kind of swing arrangements of you know, the scene with the swing arrangements.
Yeah. Well, I think it was maybe cut from this altogether, but it's somewhere else in some of the work I've been doing. I've just been talking about this remarkable moment when the lines in the sand that we sort of now kind of take for granted simply weren't there. And of course, that transitional moment where we go from the dominance of the big bands and swing music into a kind of early rock and roll, and then in Britain at the same time you have this trad revival overlaid on top of that. Because, I mean, the big bands were popular in Britain too, and then in Britain there's also a whole other layer, which is the dance band tradition, like the Henry Halls and the Giraldos and things, which is, again, doesn't really have an American model, unless you're talking about somebody like a Guy Lombardo or whatever. I found out recently that in the late 30s, Guy Lombardo had the audience attendance record at the Apollo Theater in Harlem, which starts to, I mean, we start to need to tell different histories about this. There's a great book called Pearl Harbor Jazz by an English jazz studies scholar, whose name I'm forgetting, unfortunately. Pearl Harbor Jazz, and he really unpacks some of this. He unpacks the fact that the received histories of jazz have conveniently lost a lot of this messy stuff, the stuff where all these overlaps are actually the most interesting. And that's kind of what I'm trying to do with this work too, is to tell, because most of what's been written on jazz in film has been written very much for an American context. And even the stuff that's been written for an American context, I think, refuses to acknowledge some of these kind of, you know, incredible overlaps and blurring of boundaries, because those boundaries have become so sedimented by the history, the established traditionalist histories that have been told.
Okay, that's great.
Thank you.